Introduction. Lighthouse at the End of the World, 1905, by Jules Verne, 1828-1905, is not well known in the English-speaking world. Yet this gripping adventure story, set on the remotest of islands, deserves much better. Before studying its composition, characters and themes, it is useful to summarise the plot and examine Verne's life at the turn of the century. Plot. In 1859, the Argentine sloop Santa Fe leaves Vasquez, Felipe and Maurice on deserted near polar Staten Island. They are to tend the new lighthouse at Elgo Bay and hence protect the world's ships. But a gang of wreckers, led by the diabolical Congre and Carcante, have long been stranded here. The merciless pirates hoist a light to lure the schooner Maule onto the reefs, killing all hands. In order to repair the vessel and thus escape to the South Seas, the wreckers sail her to Elgo Bay. While a powerless Vasquez observes from the lighthouse, they kill the trusting Felipe and Maurice. Unable to leave the island, the keeper needs to avoid his enemies while waiting for the sloop to return. The pirates draw in an American ship, killing all on board except First Officer John Davis. After bad weather slows the repairs, Vasquez and Davis, who have jointly sworn revenge, further delay the Maule using a salvaged cannon. The pirates are finally leaving the bay at dusk when the Santa Fe hoves into sight. The climax involves much drama and bloodshed. Biography. Verne's fascination for Latin America was visible from his childhood. His family holidayed in the idyllic French countryside at the house of his great-uncle, Prudhon Alotte de la Fouillée. Uncle Prudhon, a retired slaver, had done business in Venezuelan trading ports, and the boy idolised him for travelling so far. Verne's earliest prose publication was The First Ships of the Mexican Navy, and his third, Martin Paz, was set in Peru. Verne's life and career are useful for understanding Lighthouse. However, the main events are outlined in the chronology, so we should proceed directly to the final years. Since 1886, when his publisher had died, and a premeditated murder attempt by his favourite's nephew had left him permanently lame, Verne's life had entered a spiral of decline, with increasing isolation and plummeting popularity. The novelist turned staunchly conservative, being anti-Dreyfusard in the 1896 affair. The same year he was sued for libel. His contemporaries died one by one. His younger brother Paul in 1897, his travelling companion Aristide Ignard in 1898, his family maid in 1900, his great love and first cousin Caroline Desaunay in 1901. Verne's last journey was in 1899 to Les Petites Dalles on the Normandy coast with his son Michel and Michel's family. He resigned from the Paris Society of Geography and skipped the Universal Exposition of 1900, including the first metro. That same year, he and his wife moved out of rented accommodation at No. 2 Rue Charles Dubois, Amiens, and back to their own dark and cramped No. 44 Boulevard de Longueville. According to his biographer grandson, Jean-Jules Verne, the furniture huddled in the dining and living rooms, and the tiny garden was invaded by sparrows. On the first floor, Verne's study had just two tables, a padded armchair, and a camp bed. The novelist's health deteriorated. On the 15th of October, 1898, he wrote to his sister, "I am living off milk and eggs, and my legs are useless with rheumatism." With increasing hunger pangs from the diabetes that would kill him, he could not wait for meals, but ate alone, sitting on a stool so as to go faster. To the cataract in his left eye was added one in his right. Cancelling the needed operation in 1900 made him very distressed. I could scarcely see what I'm writing. In March 1901, a nasty flu kept him in his room for 2 months. He was very, very ill. His presence, taking refuge in silence, more aged than really old, terrified his Jean-Jules Verne, aged 9, except when he animatedly discussed his books with Jean's father, Michel. From 1902, his condition worsened, his words running away and ideas no longer coming, and many journalists departed disappointed. In 1903, the only time he went out was for his short constitutional. Yet Verne struggled on through the growing gloom. He had been triumphantly re-elected in the Amiens municipal elections of 1900, although now nodding off in meetings and speaking less and less. In 1902, he was still rising at 4 o'clock to write for 7 hours. Not only did he compose the first draft of Lighthouse between March and May 1901, but on occasion he could still appear upright like the master he is, within his eyes a singular vivacity. And still the books kept pouring out. The Mighty Orinoco in 1898, about a search for a river source. The Will of an Eccentric in 1899, a board game across the United States. The Anti-Robinsonade, Second Homeland in 1900. The Missing Link, Village in the Treetops, and the Sea Monster Yarns of Jean Cabidoulin in 1901. The Judicial Error, embroiling the Kipp brothers in 1902. Travelling Scholarships in 1903, about touring the West Indies. A Drama in Livonia, featuring German-Slav rivalry. And Master of the World in 1904, when a megalomaniac Robo the Conqueror returns in a car plane sub, and Invasion of the Sea in 1905, about flooding the Sahara. Yet others were composed, creating a backlog, for only one or two could come out each year. Magellania, where the solitude-seeking hero has to rule castaways. The Secret of Wilhelm Storitz, about an invisible man, the beautiful Yellow Danube, navigating across Central Europe, the Meteor Hunt, featuring a gold-laden asteroid, the Golden Volcano, set in the Klondike, and 4.5 chapters of Study Visit, set in French colonial Africa. On the 17th of March, 1905, the only universal Frenchman fell ill, dying on the 24th of March, surrounded by his extended family. The French government did not attend the funeral. Sources. The idea for the eponymous lighthouse probably came from the first one in the South Atlantic, the real-life beacon built in Port San Juan in 1884. While both were inexplicably positioned behind 800-foot ranges, and so invisible from most ships, the differences are more important than the similarities. Whereas Verne's beacon is the classic stone-built cylinder with a range of 8 to 10 miles, the one-story wooden lighthouse of 1884 was polygonal, with a banal galvanized roof, but a range of 14 miles. While the novel talks loftily of benefiting sailors of every nation, in reality, the motive was territorial, to shore up Argentina's brand new, still disputed sovereignty. Otherwise, the genesis of Lighthouse is largely terra incognita. Bougainville's Voyage Around the World, 1772, could be a slight source, given that rare terms like guanacos and pechere occur. The novelist may have known of Darwin's visit to the rugged and inhospitable cliffs of Staten Land. He perhaps read about a Herculean Finn called Ivan Ivanovsky, deserter from the Argentine Navy, who escaped from prison in Port San Juan 3 times between 1881 and 1885, provoking admiration at his survival, although finally succumbing to cold and starvation. Verne was presumably aware of the visit to Staten Island in 1899 of Adrien Gerlache, and Roald Amundsen's Antarctic expedition. Some of Verne's information on Patagonia was supplied by an unidentified lady correspondent in deepest Argentina. No other plausible sources have been suggested. Verne's extraordinary voyages were published as a series, with many recurring themes and situations. It may consequently be more fruitful to explore these recurrent variations, one convenient way being to simultaneously study the genre, or rather genres, the novel belongs to. Lighthouse is, firstly, a Robinsonade. The castaway genre best describes Verne infinitely more than the inaccurate science fiction label stuck on him from the 1920s, long after he was able to defend himself. Desert islands obsessed him from childhood, for the 10-year-old sailed a skiff down the Loire, sank on an island, and played at being a solitary castaway until hunger drove him home again. His only known early reading was Robinsonades, Malais de Beaulieu's 12-year-old Crusoe, Louis Desnoyers' Adventures of Robert Robert, and Ernest Fouinet's Crusoe of the Ice, followed by Johann Rudolf Wyss's Swiss Family Robinson, Defoe's Robinson Crusoe, and Fenimore Cooper's The Crater. Verne later read Captain Marryat, Mayne Reid, and Robert Louis Stevenson, especially Treasure Island, with its extraordinary freshness of style and enormous power, but also The Ebb Tide and, significantly, The Wrecker. Lighthouse is, secondly, a marine novel. Large numbers of Verne's books demonstrate his passion for navigation, which emerges even in the centre of the Earth, at the North Pole, or off on a comet. This novel remains true to type, with undoubtedly the widest range of nautical terms and themes of any of the works, paradoxically enough, as it never leaves Staten. It thus parallels Verne's own life, stranded on dry land after he gave up sailing in 1884. The novel is, lastly, defined by the island's role as gateway to the Antarctic. Verne had long been fascinated by the poles, the last virgin expanses on the globe. In 1851, he visited an uncle in Dunkirk, a major port for Arctic whalers, and subsequently wrote Wintering in the Ice, 1855. The Northern Urge also dominates Verne's 1859 journey, his first identified outside France. In the Scottish chapters of his Backwards to Britain, the hero, the Count of the North, constantly dreams of penetrating ever further into the Highlands. In 1861, Verne travelled for 5 weeks, missing the birth of his only child, Michelle. The resultant account, Joyous Miseries of Three Travellers in Scandinavia, contains a lifelong manifesto. I was drawn to the Hyperborean regions, like the magnetic needle to the north, without knowing why. I love cold lands by temperament. Verne equates altitude with latitude and the delicious chill, three scales measuring out his search for the absolute. He especially indulges his mesmeric obsession in three novels set entirely in the icy wastes: The Adventures of Captain Hatteras, 1864, The Fur Country, 1873, and An Antarctic Mystery, 1897. Both poles shared the conundrum of whether they were land or sea, the first new continent since 1606, or the open polar ocean proposed by Sir Francis Drake. While hundreds of expeditions had assaulted the Arctic, the South Pole came into vogue more slowly. In 1901, the melded dreams of a classical temperate Hyperborea and a Terra Australis Incognita burned as strongly as ever amongst scholars and cranks. Blended in were wild substrata of utopias, whether founded by Europeans to escape society's ills, or pre-existing, unsullied communities. This was where Staten Island came in. Lighthouse may in fact have been a spin-off from Magellania, written in 1898, but published only in 1909, radically altered by Michel Verne. The two novels cover the same geographical area, the same flora and fauna, the same ports. Both emphasise the danger of shipwreck and the misery of the Fuegians or Pecherais, and both revel in the inhospitality of the terrain and the fact that it remains independent of all sovereignty. Magellania closes with the erection of a lighthouse on an island, explicitly compared to the light on Staten Island. Lighthouse opens with an identical image, and indeed closes again with it. The triple depiction of the structure, defying the world, may symbolise the fight against the darkness invading Verne's eyesight and mind, against the Grim Reaper. As the writer points out in The First Explorers, 1870, Tasman discovered a Staten Island in 1642, part, he thought, of a great southern continent. It was later rebaptised New Zealand. Tasman and Darwin's use of the same geographical term for land at opposite ends of the earth shows the extent of the imagined continent and the grip it held on the global imagination. Staten Island, the remotest tip of the known continents, formed the obligatory staging post for the many cumbersome fin de siècle expeditions into the southern unknown. Together with neighbouring South Georgia, the island resembled Siberia or Greenland in both climate and tantalising otherness, a lingering whiteness on the map, an idealistic hope it might stay independent forever, blended with the selfish dream of printing one's name on the virginal expanse. Verne's problem, though, is that he has already been to both poles, in Hatteras and 20,000 Leagues. In a fallen century, where there are no discoveries left, Staten thus represents the derisory least bad solution, a mocking memory of geographical heroism, a spin-off from an already lost dream. Despite the no man's land's extreme latitude and weather, despite its brave last stand against the colonial empires, it is in many ways a retreat. Travel is pointless, for everything has been done. All Verne's islands represent this pitiful inversion of the voyage, the aim of his life and works. Staten can be seen as both the culmination and the denial of the polar urge, both a new discovery and the reluctant recognition that salvation can no longer be sought through geography. Lighthouse is a dream of elsewhere, tempered for a bourgeois century. Composition. While the inspiration for Lighthouse remains a black box, we do have information about its path to publication. On the 29th of March 1901, 3 years after Magellania, Verne finished writing The Beautiful Yellow Danube. That same day, he began Lighthouse, completing the draft on the 17th of May. Jean-Jules Verne claims the novel was written during a period of depression, but may simply be arguing from its sombre tone. Examination of the manuscript shows that, as usual, Verne inked over his pencil draft, then made a few minor deletions and insertions. With an increasing backlog of unpublished novels, he normally did the ink version several years after the pencil one. His errors betrayed his failing eyesight and fatigue, with words incorrectly crossed out. The writing, however, remains nearly as well formed as ever. As in the previous manuscripts, there are a few gaps for distances, technical words, etc. On the 25th of February 1905, we have the first mention of Lighthouse in Verne's extant correspondence. He told Hetzel Fies, his publisher since 1886, "I will soon send you the manuscript. It will probably not be the one I mentioned, The Invisible Man, but Lighthouse at the End of the World, set on the last tip of Tierra del Fuego." In addition to Invasion of the Sea, which had started coming out in Hetzel's Magazine of Education and Recreation on the 1st of January, another book was needed for August. On the 4th of March, Hetzel wrote to confirm receipt of the manuscript, later remarking that although he had not actually read it, the title itself was destined to succeed. However, he continued, it would overshadow the title of Invasion of the Sea, so it was perhaps stupid to publish them in the same annual volume. He inquired whether Verne could send The Invisible Man. Verne replied on the 5th of March that he had posted Lighthouse because he thought there would not be changes to it, but he agreed to send what he preferred to call Storitz's Secrets. On the 12th of March, Hetzel confirmed that he had received the new manuscript, but said he had to leave for Italy, having left instructions for it to be copied so he could read it on his return. On the 24th of March, Verne died. Clearly, he considered the manuscript finished, qua manuscript, but he had earlier pointed out, I consider my real labour begins with my first set of proofs, for I not only correct something in every sentence, but rewrite whole chapters. However, according to Hetzel Fies, with age and infirmity, there were some books which Verne did not revise intensively on proofs, and their sales suffered. In sum, Verne would certainly have made many changes to Lighthouse at the successive proof stages. On the 30th of April, Michel Verne wrote a letter to Le Figaro and Le Temps, referring to 8 manuscript works, including 1 volume of stories, but mentioning only 3 actual titles. All 8 were in his physical possession, except Lighthouse and Storitz. Who now owned the right to bring out the 8 works, and these 2 in particular? Hetzel wrote that he had been charged by Monsieur Jules Verne to publish the 8 posthumous works, including Lighthouse, while retaining the author's text as much as possible, except where there were mistakes. On the 9th of May, the publisher wrote to Michel that he could not return the manuscripts of Lighthouse and Storitz as requested, since Verne had sent them for publication, and that Verne's son could contact a lawyer if he wished. The following day, a visibly upset Michel countered that on his deathbed, his father had explained why he had submitted 2 manuscripts, saying that his son could do as he wished with them. Michel also referred to his father's will, which read, I hereby bequeath all my manuscripts, books, maps, library and papers without exception, to my son Michel Verne. In sum, the manuscripts belonged to Michel, and he had the power to refuse publication. Hetzel responded on the 11th of May that he was consulting his own lawyer, and attached a note concerning the manuscript Lighthouse at the End of the World, summarising the epistolary exchanges of early March. He maintained that he had the right to bring Lighthouse out, although later agreeing to return Storitz. At this point, although he seems to have been legally and morally in the right, Michel gave in. On the 25th of June, perhaps heartened by a handsome publisher's cheque, he wrote about a backup copy of the manuscript of Lighthouse. I read it this morning. I realised that it needed very few changes, all of small details. He added he would start correcting it as a matter of urgency. Lighthouse was then serialised in Hetzel's magazine from the 15th of August to the 15th of December. The first publication in volume form was in about November, with the copyright date surprisingly indicated as the 29th of July, 1905. The text had been slightly revised from the magazine. Hetzel Fies and Verne Fies signed a contract in March 1906, covering Lighthouse and the 7 other manuscripts. It stipulated, notably, that Mr. Michel Jules Verne undertakes to carry out the revisions and corrections which may be necessary on each of these volumes. 7 works duly came out from 1906 to 1914. In English, the book first appeared as Congre the Wrecker, or The Lighthouse at the End of the World, in the boy's own paper, October 1914 to September 1915. Then, in volume form with Sampson Low, 1923. Cranston Metcalfe's translation, of relatively good quality, was praised in the New York Times for the velocity and the variety of the narrative. Surprisingly, however, no substantive book review or study of Lighthouse had been produced in any language at the moment of writing. The inevitably unfaithful Spanish-American film got poor reviews in 1971, although one critic praised the harsh realism. 10 minutes were cut for US cinemas. Set partly at night, and with a woman added and raped, Yul Brynner and Kirk Douglas remain the focus of attention as the opposing protagonists. Thinking about Lighthouse has, however, been transformed recently. At a 1978 conference in Cerisy in Normandy, scholar Piero Gondolo della Riva showed that the posthumous works were not really by Jules Verne, for Michel's revisions and additions were substantial, amounting as much as to two-thirds of each work. His argument was based on the typescripts of 5 works, not including Lighthouse, previously in the possession of Hetzel's Heritors. These were very different from the published versions, but conformed to the manuscripts owned by Jean-Jules Verne. 3 years later, the grandson's estate sold the 90-plus manuscripts to the city of Nantes for 6 million francs. The Société Jules Verne then published the original Jules Verne versions of the 5 novels from 1985 to 1989, reportedly with the approval of Nantes in the case of Storitz. Jules's manuscript of Lighthouse, which had not been examined closely in the mistaken belief that Michel made few changes, was finally published in 1999. It is this version that appears here for the first time in English. We now, therefore, have 2 versions of the novel, the one entirely by Jules, and the one revised by Michel, henceforth the Michel version, and so can assess their relative value. The general question of the posthumous alterations has generated a great deal of heat in France. Many critics consider the Michel versions better in significant respects. Points out that the Jules manuscripts are sometimes repetitive and clumsy. In the article that started off the whole debate, Gondolo della Riva considers that several of the novels published before 1905 lack action and originality, with too many enumerations and digressions, whereas the posthumous works are rich with ideas, due to Michel's intervention. Martin concurs, opining that the main interest of the posthumous novels comes most often from the son's work. Compère argues that, since Verne always revised extensively on proofs, the posthumous text is closer to his intentions than the manuscript version, which represents a mere first draft. A review of Magalania argues that it reads like an outline rather than a polished book, with little happening for the first 100 pages, and too much telling and not enough showing. But that Michel's version, in contrast, although reflecting his own personal views, constitutes a vivid literary novel with comprehensive development of the many ideological cross-currents. However, in a co-authored article of 2000, Gondolo della Riva apparently changes position, now stating that Michel's revisions often traduce the thinking of the author. Mostly in the bulletin that he himself edits, Dumas has written scores of polemical articles on the posthumous question with excessive vehemence, according to the Extrapolation Review. He strenuously argues that Michel's work on the posthumous volumes was duplicitous and morally reprehensible. In the case of Lighthouse, he says the son failed to check the typescript against the manuscript, weakens the style, and that nearly all his changes were for the worse. His position is reflected in his title, Do You Prefer the True or Fake Jules Verne? Dumas's arguments have greatly influenced debate, especially the half dozen popular biographies that came out for the centenary in 2005. It may be expected that publishers with access to expert legal advice and reputations at stake would have addressed the three decades old Jules Michel question of the posthumous works, if only to reconsider the authorship formula of their books. But such a view overestimates their literary sensibility and speed of reaction. Apart from publishers specifically producing the Jules version, a deafening silence has ensued. Livre de Poche has issued neither edition of the posthumous novels since 1978, and a few publishers, including one of the English Lighthouse, are still continuing to issue the Michel version under Jules Verne's sole name, despite the clear untruth and illegality of such an action. The Michel controversy is, then, still in full flow, in France at least. Most critics have taken on trust Dumas's claim of the literary superiority of Jules's version. However, his arguments have often been one-sided and indeed tendentious, and commentary to date has suffered from a lack of a detailed comparison of the two texts. Even Dumas admits that the manuscript of Lighthouse needs some revision. In addition to the errors of crossing out and the gaps, there are stylistic tics, such as the overuse of sentences beginning with and then, and indeed, or here is. Some of the paragraph divisions also seem redundant. Although the text reads well, in the later chapters Verne may perhaps go too far in drawing up hypotheses in elaborate detail, then repeating them, although often the contemplated eventuality never happens. A better balance between creation of anxiety and depiction of gruesome events might sometimes be preferable. Michel makes few changes in chapters 1 to 3. The remainder of Verne's text sometimes has inappropriate prepositions, lacks continuity, or contains inconsistencies. Michel corrects factual discrepancies, polishes and shortens sentences, improves flow, and cuts repetition. Despite their number, his changes rarely introduce new material. He attempts, the most often successfully, to render the text more concise and coherent. In later chapters, Michel removes Vasquez's tears and appeals to divine aid. He adds an episode of 6 pages in chapter 13, where Vasquez heroically blows up the schooner's rudder with a cartridge he has invented. Finally, he improves the paragraph concluding the book. In previous studies of Jules Verne's manuscripts, I have keenly defended the original versions of the novels, since the involvement of Hetzel Peer often distorted the contents, including the plot and the ideology. But in the case of Lighthouse, I consider Michel's interventions different, since they are concerned with consistency, brevity, elegance and balance, rarely changing the contents. To a large extent, they represent what Jules himself might have done. In the absolute, we must consider Michel's changes on balance, improvements of the book. However, the modern tendency is to restore literary texts to versions before editing by publishers and later generations, and Verne has the moral right for his text to be available. As a result, literary scholars at least are obliged to refer to the Jules Verne version. It is hoped the present edition can contribute to the debate on the merits of the two books. In some ways, Lighthouse is the writer's lost illusions. Always a trenchant observer of human society, often mocking humanity's greed and thirst for power. Even Verne's earliest works rarely present human endeavour positively, apart from the quickly exhausted exploration of new lands. Knowledge for the sake of it, family life, indulgence of the senses, public service, political or social improvement, all values appear skew-if in Verne. Science receives short shrift, except as a quicker method to transport the characters away from modern civilization, In the later works, science has become systematically nefarious, and the pessimism, which had been present since before Paris in the 20th century, becomes stronger. After the first great wave of geographical discovery, what is lacking is simply any metaphysical system, any successful transcendence, any explicit vision of what life is about. All Verne's creatures are first cousins to Captain Nemo and Phileas Fogg, unable or unwilling to articulate any coherent scheme of things, any overall philosophy. As a result, and according to the definition of modernity as escaping the ideological straitjackets of the century, whether social, political, religious, or academic, the French novelist must be considered to verge on the postmodern. Anyone looking for explicit messages in Lighthouse will be disappointed. What the reader finds instead is a suspense thriller, crossed with a desert island and sea novel. Verne usually inserts an occasional comic scene in his dramatic or tragic works, but light relief is entirely lacking here. While Lighthouse has been called as desolate and harsh as the landscapes it describes, most critics have praised its readability and ingenious plotting. Some have argued that the story is slight, or that the literary qualities do not reach those of the other works of the period. However, others have nothing but praise, lauding its purity and simplicity, calling it a very fine novel, and unequivocally defining it as a little masterpiece. Those expecting a psychological novel or a science fiction one will nevertheless be disappointed. Characters and even action are secondary, and science plays no role. Women are totally and irrevocably absent, apart from the true heroine, the sea. Her perfect companion is the lighthouse, a powerful symbol of the impotence of human technology against the savage elements. Against all the bloodshed and evil, the darkness, death and despair, the beacon brings only a little light. Positive action in a fallen world can at best hold back the dark forces for a while. Almost as a backdrop to the raging natural forces, two tales of suspense run in parallel, Congre and Carcante's attempts to escape before the authorities return, and Vasquez and Davis's efforts to stop them. The narration identifies with the intelligent and far-reaching cogitations of each group, and ultimately, and contradictorily, with both. But heroes and villains are kept apart, in both the chapter structure and the flesh. Only at the very end does the camera pan from attackers to attacked, who meet for the first time at the lighthouse, and in death. Verne's four main characters are relatively well drawn for an adventure story. All are equally determined and energetic, experienced and brave. Argentine Chief Petty Officer Vasquez, without a Christian name, is 47 but still hale and hearty, and inspires confidence as head keeper. Having sailed the seven seas with the Navy and volunteered for the lighthouse, he wrongheadedly tries to convince his fellow keepers their isolation is not frightening. After the massacre, his sole thought is revenge, with regular appeals to his God, an Old Testament-style one, a million miles from Christian ideas of forgiveness or redemption. But God, as distinct from Providence, rarely intervenes in the extraordinary journeys, and Vasquez, surviving through his own audacity, has to do all his dirty work for him. American John Davis, hailing from Mobile, 30 to 35, ex-Navy, first officer in the Merchant Marine, has an iron temperament. Davis and Vasquez are both passionate and efficacious individuals, working perfectly together. Davis's control and laconicism, complementing the Argentine's hot-headedness and occasional sentimentality. Although of superior rank, Davis follows rather than leads, presumably because he is younger and not on home ground. Congre, 40, possesses no other name. It is not even clear whether he is European or Indian. a former captain. His first piratical activities were near the Solomons. With wild features and a thick beard, he is a combinatorial genius like Vasquez, a laconic, efficient doer like Davis, courageous, persistent and loyal like them both, and a violent sociopath, almost in the Lector League, in calculating his own naked advantage. At the end, rather than give in, he proudly chooses the absolute gesture. Chilean Carcanti is 35 to 40, of unknown family and origin, of medium height but sinewy, immensely strong and brave, a faithful deputy and a false heart. He similarly stops at nothing. The titanic struggle between good and evil, between civilization and its enemies, is thus presented here in its most basic, stripped-down form. With cold perseverance and great resourcefulness on both sides, Lighthouse resembles a game of chess played by Hong Kong businessmen, endlessly guessing what the opponent might know and doing multivariate probabilistic analysis on the multiply branching courses of action open to them. Verne's wish, of course, is for civilized behavior and convictions to finally beat human savagery. In other words, he poses a similar question, but distributes good and evil differently. In the Robor novels, light and dark mix and fight within the same great mind. In 20,000 Leagues, the question is simply how to respond when unjustly attacked. This simultaneously moral and practical question is often avoided by the woolly-minded in safe democracies. What to do when confronted with ruthless adversaries? Behave like them, or uphold liberal standards? Lighthouse answers that there is no perfect response, that civilized behavior does not win the day. For two of the three keepers die, together with scores of innocent shipwrecked sailors. Turning the other cheek is never contemplated. Although evil eventually loses all the more, the bleak conclusion is that life is not always fair. There is no universal redemption. But to compensate, Verne's main answer is practical and resounding. You riposte, and you seek full revenge and punishment. As a result, there are an unusual number of deaths in this tale, making one wonder what effect it had on the children it was often given to. With perfect unity of time and place, with fatal wrecks, cruel pirates and model sailors, Lighthouse is the only extraordinary journey without a journey. A pagan story of sky, land and water, mixed with wind, wave and rock, it revels sensually in the tempting cavities, the vertical cliffs, and the climactically tempestuous hurricanes. In guise of conclusion, it may be best simply to cite Metcalfe's of 80 years ago. Lighthouse at the End of the World stands out through the remoteness of its setting, its creation of dramatic dread, the excitement of its race against time. The rest is pure action, courage and resourcefulness, pitted against ferocity and power of numbers. The greatness of Jules Verne, unparalleled master of the adventure story, is perhaps most apparent in his simplest work. Background note on Staten Island. Although situated entirely in the Atlantic Ocean, Staten Island, Isla de los Estados, is the last fragment of the Magellanic Archipelago, or Magallanes, the culminating point of the Andes mountain range, and the end of the Americas. One of the few uninhabited areas in the world, it lies east of Lemaire Strait, used by the ships doubling Cape Horn, and where the world's two greatest oceans clash. With 73 days of storm a year, 250 inches of precipitation, and a mean temperature of 2 or 3 degrees centigrade, snow lies for 8 months a year. Mountainous, but with more than 100 lakes that feed streams and waterfalls, it now forms a nature reserve. The south coast appears particularly desolate and daunting, punished by storms straight from the pole. Before the Panama Canal opened in 1914, thousands of ships used this strait en route to Australia, Asia, or the west coast of America, despite the 6-knot currents, stormy seas, and frequent fogs, and despite the 7 or 8 ships wrecked on its shores every year. Although sometimes considered part of Tierra del Fuego, Land of Fire, Verne himself implies it is separate, and therefore also probably from Patagonia, though not from the Magallanes. The region was discovered by Magellan in 1520, when he sailed through the Strait of Magellan. In 1578, Sir Francis Drake sighted the point baptized Cape Horn in 1616 by Dutchmen Lemaire and Schouten. These two navigators also discovered new land, calling it Staten, in honour of the States of Holland. They believed it to be part of a southern continent, but it was circumnavigated in 1643. Visited by buccaneers, including Bartholomew Sharp, Cavendish, Drake, and Hawkins, used as a hiding place over the centuries by gangs operating from the Falklands, Staten Island was visited by James Cook in 1768 and 1774 to 1775. Mooring in Port San Juan, he killed large numbers of sea lions and fur seals for oil, then sailed southeast in search of an elusive Antarctic continent. Many other explorers' names are linked with the island, some because they were wrecked on it. The sovereignty of the island was indeterminate for most of the 19th century. After losing some of her North American colonies in 1776, Britain thought of settlement in the area to support whalers and sealers. In 1792, the Spanish arrived on Staten Island for the first time. Rumours also came that the lost colony of New Ireland had been on Staten, but no systematic exploration or nomenclature was attempted until Philip Parker King in 1826 to 1828, and Robert Fitzroy with the young Charles Darwin in 1831 to 1836. The exploration work was continued by Louis Vernet, 1826, Jules Dumont d'Urville, 1837, Charles Wilkes, 1839, and William Parker Snow, 1855. There were no confirmed European settlements in the Magallanes until 1865. Argentina, independent since 1816, claimed Staten Island as a dependency of the Falklands, and granted the island to Luis Piedrabuena in 1868, from whom the British unsuccessfully tried to buy half for wood for the Falklands. The island remained the private property of Buenos Aires until the Argentine government purchased it in 1912. As late as 1881, a treaty gave Chile possession of most of the Magallanes, with Argentina taking less than half of Tierra del Fuego Island, plus Staten Island. However, the frontier was still so controversial in 1887 that Hetzel Fies refused to publish a map showing it.